Good morning, everybody. So thank you all for being here. It's my pleasure to begin this session on gene therapy beyond clinical, current clinical trials. So I'd like to start by, before getting to the novelties and details of the different approaches for gene therapy, I thought it would be nice to loosely define gene therapy. So to start easy. So gene therapy, as you all know, is the use of any kind of genetic material, let this be RNA, DNA, in combination with a vector. So this can be a viral vector, mostly adeno-associated virus or lentivirus. In combination with the gene becomes a therapeutic intervention. So this therapeutic intervention can be useful in inherited retinal disease or in complex diseases. And the idea is to reverse, slow down, or treat retinal disease in a smart way to prevent blindness or to reverse it. So there's different possibilities for gene therapy. And the first one and the most logical, straightforward approach is what we call gene addition. This is also referred to as gene replacement or gene supplementation. And this is a useful approach for monogenic recessive diseases. And the idea is to take a healthy copy of a mutated gene and bring it into the affected cell. And by bringing the healthy copy of the defective gene, making a normal gene product and thereby reversing the disease. And this approach has been implemented very successfully and is now referred to as the first clinical success of gene therapy by three different groups, first led by Jean Bennett, who's here present. She will give you a lot more detail on this, and two other groups who've actually taken this approach all the way to the clinic and now into the phase two and three stages. In their case, the mutated gene was the RPE65 gene found in the retinal pigment epithelium. So this gene defect is a monogenic and recessive one, and they were able to show that bringing an adeno-associated virus carrying a healthy copy of the RPE65, we are really able to make a gene drug, and this is safe and to some extent beneficial. So this really increased the amount of investment and interest there is in gene replacement therapy. And in the years that followed this first clinical success, there's been implementation in many other diseases. So the LCA2 clinical trials that started out in 2007 were quickly followed by clinical trials on Stargardt, USH1B, retinoschisis, choroideremia, and now the gene replacement therapy approach is even moving further down. So there's now gene therapy not just for the retina, but also for optic nerve disease, like Leber-Herrod's teleoptic neuropathy, and there's more gene replacement coming in the pipeline for achromatopsia. So like I said, there's more investment and more interest in this, but although this growing interest, we need to really look beyond gene replacement therapy. Why so? Because gene replacement, like I said, can only be useful if there's a known mutation, and that's not always the case, and it's monogenic and it's recessive, and the photoreceptors are still intact. Although we all know that what can be done for the majority of patients who have retinal disease, actually there's more people who have complex disease and are affected with dominant mutations or no longer have photoreceptors. So we really need to be thinking about this large patient population and what gene therapy can offer to them. So this is what I'd like to focus on for my talk. And what we can do for these people are the approaches that we call the mutation-independent gene therapies. So what are those? They come in several forms. One idea is to use secretable factors for gene therapy. And these secretable factors are mostly dealing with the consequences of the disease rather than the cause, and this is why it's mutation-independent gene therapy. And there's been a first example of using this approach in the clinic. So the secretable factors can be either trophic factors, anti-angiogenic factors, anti-apoptotic factors, and they can be useful in complex diseases just as good as inherited diseases. And this is what's nice about them. And the first clinical trial using a secretable factor has been the S-FLIT study, aiming to treat neovascular AMD. This was an effort that was undertaken by Genzyme, who's now a Sanofi company, and what they did is that they aimed at controlling ocular neovascularization via blockade of VEGF by expressing a portion of the soluble FLIT receptor in order to keep endothelial growth factor under control. So an adeno-associated virus, an AAV, was used again to express S-FLIT, and this was administered to patients with neovascular AMD, and this has been going on since 2010, and hopefully we will have results soon with the completion of the trials. So now, this is more or less a wrap-up on what is in the clinic already. Now I will switch gears and go to what is coming up very soon, hopefully, in form of mutation-independent therapy. So a next approach is, again, a secretable factor, which is very precious to us at the Vision Institute, which we would really like to see come to the clinic in the next few years. It's a trophic factor called rod-derived cone viability factor that's been developed for in the last over 10 years, actually, by Professor Sahal and Leveillard. This is a retina-specific trophic factor that rods secrete and that promote the survival of cone photoreceptors, the photoreceptors that are actually the most useful to us for our daylight and high acuity vision, that we would like to preserve for as long as possible in retinal degeneration, especially in rod cone dystrophies. So the idea behind RDCVF in form of gene therapy is that we're not going to be injecting the RDCVF protein, but we're going to encapsulate the gene encoding RDCVF into an adeno-associated virus, and we're going to deliver this into the retinas in order to have continuous secretion of this trophic factor, who's going to delay the death of cone photoreceptors for as long as possible. So I had the pleasure of participating in the study where we've done a first proof of concept demonstration that RDCVF can be a very efficient gene therapy in the RD10 mouse. This was a collaboration between University of California, Berkeley and the Vision Institute, where we were able to show that we can deliver high levels of RDCVF to RD10 mouse retina, suffering from retinitis pigmentosa, and the delivery of RDCVF extends the functional life of cones and also preserves the number of cones for much longer than what would happen if we let the disease progress naturally. So this is a very compelling approach and that we're hoping to see with investment also from the Foundation Fighting Blindness and a lot of investment from our institute come to the clinic in the next few years. So now, beyond the loss of the cone outer segment, what can we do with gene therapy for retinal degeneration? So now we enter into vision restoration, what can be a very useful approach, gene therapeutic approach, for restoring vision once it's been lost. So once the cone outer segments are gone, once we've gone beyond the point of how long we can maintain them with RDCVF or any other trophic approach, the only choice that we have is to restore vision by using other means. So our vision depends on the complex G-protein coupled cascade mediated by rhodopsins and conopsins. It's a very complex cascade that is highly light sensitive and that is found in these outer segments that are highly packed with this machinery. But once these outer segments are gone, it's very difficult to make these cells light sensitive again. However, the discovery of microbial opsins in the last 10 years have really given a bright idea to neurosciences, but also to gene therapy concerning the retina, about using much simpler, robust opsins that come from microorganisms such as algae or microbes, and to take these one component channels or pumps and insert them into the retinal circuitry where the light sensitivity has been lost, and in order to obtain light sensitivity. Of course, the sensitivity is going to be a lot less great than the sensitivity we can obtain with our complex G-protein coupled cascade and outer segments. However, this can still be useful for restoring vision. And Botan Roska here present has been a pioneer in demonstrating that the ease of restoring signal processing in the retina is really inversely proportional to where we put these microbial opsins. So through a lot of years of experimentation, he's shown that actually the best place to restore vision in the retina once the outer segments of the cones are gone would be the dormant cone cell bodies. And once these are gone, of course, we know that some patients have already lost these. The second best place to go would be the on-bipolar cells and then the retinal ganglion cells. And in fact, this is why in the vision restoration with optogenetics, we need to think about multiple strategies that we're going to develop in parallel. So there's going to be multiple leads that are going to be developed for the needs of multiple subpopulations of patients. So here I'm showing you OCT images from different patients affected with RP, and you see that some of them have a lot of photoreceptors, the cone photoreceptors, that are still present, and others don't even have a very intact bipolar cell layer, but they all have in common retinal ganglion cells. So the idea is to develop different leads. So one lead would be to develop something like halo rhodopsin or any hyperpolarizing opsin that can be inserted into the cone cell bodies. Or other leads would be something like either channel rhodopsin or more sensitive versions like catch. or red-shifted variants like REGR or crimson that can be inserted into the retinal ganglion cells and that are depolarizing optogenes. So this is some work that we've been pursuing and developing. So one, a proof of concept has already been accomplished by Botan-Roska's group, where they've shown that insertion of hyperpolarizing halorhodopsin into the dormant cones can be a very efficient way of restoring vision, at least for about 6 months. But the question we asked in the Vision Institute was, what will happen beyond the six-month period? Would we want to give patients vision back for a limited amount of time? Or is that somehow frustrating? So we thought actually at 12 months, there's so little cones remaining that the efficacy of the approach goes down. So an idea that we've been pursuing is prolonging the lifetime of reactivating cones through the use of hyperpolarizing microbial opsins by implementing on top of the optogene, survival factor, RDCVF, a trophic factor. So the idea is to implement RDCVF and thereby trophically support cones so that they would be intact and survive longer, function longer, but when they no longer have the outer segment, they can then switch on to the halorhodopsin or equivalent like JAWS. So this is a project that's been pursued in my lab by a graduate student, Anand, who's shown that we can actually insert both the optogene and the RDCVF together. The vector combinations for getting this to work out was quite complex, but she's now gotten there. And this, the implementation of RDCVF obviously shows an improvement in the ERG and also in the behavior measured by optokinetic reflex. And she's also shown that implementation of JAWS, like halorhodopsin, it's efficient in order to provide better, higher percentage of cells responding to light in treated retinas on multi-electrode array recordings. And now we're awaiting the one-year time period where she's going to show the combination of the two is obviously more beneficial, and we have a higher amount of surviving cones, thus better optogenetic responses. So now what we've also been doing is in parallel developing these two other leads where we're inserting depolarizing channels into the ganglion cells, the cell population that is maintained in all patients. So this is a concept that's been as old as the use of optogenetics in the retina. First use goes 10 years back to this publication by Bai and Pan, where they've actually shown for the first time that optogenetics can be a useful therapeutic strategy for vision restoration. So they put channel rhodopsin back in the days, they referred to it as CHOP, into the retinal ganglion cells of an RD1 mouse who's lost all photoreceptors, and they've shown that this can restore some sort of light sensitivity. Now, 10 years down the line, what we're trying to do is really make this happen in the clinic, and it is really happening in the clinic right now. There's effort invested both in academia and also in companies such as RetroSense and GemSight. So when we really want to bring this to the clinic, what needs to be done in view of translation, these are some of the problems that we've tackled over the past few years. So we know that despite the success in rodents, and not just the pioneering work by Bai and Pan, but all the work that has contributed to this field afterwards, we know that high-level channel rhodopsin or microbial opsin expression is required to get light activation. And this high-level expression can lead to immune responses to both the transgene and to the amount of AAV that is needed to provide this kind of high-level expression. So this is the issue that we decided to focus on for the translation, and we decided that this risk can be reduced by increasing the specificity and the efficiency of the expression system. So the AAV and the promoter have a big part in this. So what we decided to do is find a promoter that is a lot more specific and efficient in order to get higher amount of expression with the same number of AAV particles, and also use a variant of channel rhodopsin that was initially used, which is much more sensitive, like catch, for example, and of course implement the red-shifted variants later on. So here I illustrate this with the catch example. So increasing the specificity required first inventing, finding a promoter that is able to provide high-level expression in RGCs. We found such promoter, I will refer to it as RET. So this RET promoter is able to really afford much higher level expression than the ubiquitous promoters like both CMV and CAG that's been used in the past. And we've shown that, of course, dose response in the response that we're able to get with this kind of promoter is much more efficient in mice. So here I'm showing you different doses of AAV that was used to introduce catch into retinal ganglion cells of RD1 mice. And the percentage of cells responding to light in this situation with CMV or RET promoter. And you can see that with lower amount of light, we get responses that are robust with our retinal cell specific promoter because it expresses catch at higher levels. So in order to use less light and less AAV and get still robust responses at the safe range, we decided to use the pharmacological equivalent of 5×10⁹ particles that was used in mice to go to the primate for translation, and we used macaques. So what we did, macaque has about 100 times more vitreous than mice. We injected the 100 times greater dose in the macaque to obtain the same efficacy. And indeed, this is what was done in three non-human primates. Four eyes were injected with AAV encoding catch, and others, just one eye with catch infusion with the fluorescent protein in order to follow the kinetics of expression. In all of these cases, we followed the eyes, first for any signs of inflammation, because this is the critical point, since we're introducing for the first time a foreign transgene into the body of a macaque. And we've seen that we got very transitory inflammatory responses. What you can see, the anterior chamber flare, the corneal precipitase and vitreal haze were all relatively minor and resolved by month three in all of these macaques. And we also looked quickly at one eye that was injected with this dose for any signs of retinal inflammation at the structural level, and we did not see any signs of damage. So then we went on to asking, is it also efficient? And we've seen that with this dose and with this promoter, we're able to obtain efficient responses. So when we take this normal macaque retina and block the endogenous phototransduction using LAP4, what happens is that we get the responses that come directly from the catch. And these colocalize very well with the area, this perifoveal ring, where the catch is expressed. And the responses start at about 10^15 photons per centimeter squared per second. So we've looked at this at the population level by MEA recordings, but also by two photon guided patch clamp, where we were able to show both in presence and in absence of the GFP conjugate, we're able to see very nice, robust catch-like responses from these patched and recorded cells. So this was very encouraging. We did a parallel study where we used a red-shifted Chandra Dobson variant called Crimson. This time we even went beyond the 3 months that was studied with catch. And at 6 months, we're seeing that we get robust responses that are much more red-shifted with Crimson in a similar way to what we were obtaining with catch. These give us plenty of hope that we're ready for translation of these two strategies to the clinic in the very near future. A collaboration with GenSight Therapeutics. So what technologies are needed for future gene therapies? This is something that I wanted to talk a little bit more about, since the aim is to set the stage for a good discussion after the session. So to my eyes, in terms of technologies, what are really important for all modes of gene therapy, and also especially for the gene therapies that I talked about, is going to be the development of vector and promoter systems for use in humans, because the vectors thus far have been extensively developed and optimized for rodents. And obviously, vectors with larger carrying capacity would be beneficial in order for us to allow usage of larger promoter sequences or package larger transgenes. And in parallel, the technologies on gene silencing and gene editing would be beneficial for gene correction, which is yet another avenue that I didn't address here. And of course, more light-sensitive options would be great, although I don't know physically if we can go higher than the sensitivity of the ones that we currently have. But these would be definitely beneficial. So for my interests and my group's interests, I want to just say a few words about vectors and promoters suitable for human use and how we're tackling this challenge, how we've done it in the past, and how we're in the process of doing it for clinical translation. So the practical challenge for all modes of gene therapy, like I mentioned, is the problem of the vectors. We are using AAV, adeno-associated virus, that nature did not create at all to transfect retinal cells. This is actually a respiratory virus, and we're asking it to go and highly efficiently transfect retinal cells. So we're basically asking the poor virus to do something that he hasn't been trained at all to do, and this is why we have a virus that is still very efficient, but it's not quite as efficient as what we would like it to be. For example, let me use this example to illustrate. In the mouse eyes, since we've been fiddling with AAVs for a long time, engineering them, making them better, now we have AAVs that are rather efficient, that are able to cover at least all all of the retina. And in fact, even off the shelf, the naturally occurring AAV2 variant is able to cover the entity of the retinal surface when we inject it into the vitreous. However, if you take that same AAV, you up the dose by 100-fold to meet the pharmacological equivalent in the macaque eye, and you introduce it into the eye of a macaque, you get this expression that is very limited, like I've shown you also with CATCH, to the perifoveal ganglion cells, because this is the place where the inner limiting membrane of the macaque retina is thin enough that AAV gets access to the retinal cells. So the transduction in the rodent, when we play the AAV game, is not good in predicting the transduction patterns in primate. And the immune reactions in rodents are minimal, unlike primates, so we're not even dealing with this constraint. So what, in order to make AAVs that are better for the mouse retina, let me show you an idea of how this has been done in the past. So AAV can actually be engineered to perform much better in a given tissue. For example, if we take AAV and we tailor it a little bit with bioengineering to meet the needs of gene therapy, what can be done is that we can use the AAV capsid gene, so this vehicle that carries the gene, and use it as an input to create diversities of AAV that maybe do not even exist in nature. And by creating diversities of this gene by molecular engineering techniques such as random peptide insertions or random mutagenesis or shuffling of the capsid gene between the existing serotypes, we can obtain really highly diverse AAVs with surprising properties. And then these diversities of AAV can be screened for variants that are able to do what we ask it to do. So for example, a paradigm that I attacked during my postdoc was to try to make an AAV that would penetrate all across the retina and deliver genes all the way into the deeper retinal layers. And the selection pressure that we put on these libraries that we generated was the ability to penetrate into the retina and go all the way into the nuclei of the photoreceptor cells. And we were able to do this because we had a transgenic mouse line that expressed a GFP in its rod photoreceptors. So we would inject these diverse libraries and select out the photoreceptors in order to find variants that were able to make it into these cells while we were getting rid of the inner retinal cells. So this allowed us to enrich AAVs that are able to penetrate deeper into the retina and deliver genes much more efficiently. And in fact, this repeating this kind of selection process, we imitated evolution in nature, and we ended up with a dominant clone that converged, that the evolution converged onto, that we baptized 7m8. And this variant had the particularity of having a 7m insertion at a very particular site. And we thought there was something very special about the sequence that would allow us to get better retinal penetration. And indeed, when we studied this variant, we were able to see that compared to the parental AAV2, it's able to penetrate all the way into the deepest layers of the retina and deliver here the GFP very efficiently. And the good news is then you can combine this variant, deliver it into the vitreous, and combine it with any cell type specific promoter to get expression in the cell types that you want. This allowed us to do beautiful proof of concept demonstrations for retinoschisis gene therapy in the mouse. Later on, we also used it for delivering channel rhodopsin to the on-bipolar cells, specifically under the control of a specific promoter for the cell type, and obtain vision restoration. So really, we made a tool that is useful for all modes of gene therapy. So now what we would like to be able to do is, of course, do the same thing in humans, make one vector that would target all cells with efficient and low doses. Unfortunately, we're not quite there yet, because if you take this variant that was made in mice and you apply it in the macaque, you will see that the results are not all that fantastic. In the mouse, we obtain exactly what we want, but in the macaque, we go beyond the foveal ring, okay, but we get mostly peripheral expression and some extension of the expression into the foveal cones, but most of the macula, which is of great interest for a lot of gene therapy, still remains untransduced. So what in my group and several other groups, including some biotech companies, are doing right now is applying the same idea, the same directed evolution of approach, however, this time using macaque retinas or other primate retinas in order to find variants that are going to be evolved to transduce the primate retina and who are hopefully going to be able to transduce also human retina. So these are results that we're awaiting that are hopefully going to unblock a lot of gene therapies that are in the pipeline. So once we have these technologies, the vectors, the promoters, and all the other things that are going to be in place, what is still going to be necessary is going to be better animal models and also a better understanding of the immune reactions to the vectors and transgenes that are going to be really important from my point of view for the development of gene therapeutic strategies. So with that, I hope I set the stage for the next talks and for some very nice discussion. I'd like to finish by thanking all of my colleagues whom I have the privilege to work with, and GenSight and FFP and all of our funding organizations, as well as Max Planck Innovation, who are contributing to the development of the CATCH approach. So I'm happy to take questions, I think, at the end of the session.